From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Mountain View.
San Rafael.
Lower Haight, San Francisco.
Brentwood.
Corte Madera.
Pleasant Hill.
Coming up, we'll explore a whole new world.
Sony, Samsung, Google, Microsoft, and the hardware companies are all competing right now. There is this arms race to get virtual reality in your living room first.
Then we'll talk to an East Bay violinist about making the move from classical to jazz.
You know, I couldn't help it when I was playing like Vivaldi's Four Seasons. I remember at the competition, like, I wanted to tap my feet, so I was kind of hiding it.
And we find out the answer to this week's audiograph mystery sound. Who won the blue ribbon? Find out today on Cross Currents. Virtual reality has been a science fiction staple for decades, and it always kind of looks the same. You strap on some headgear with a large, high-tech-looking visor that lets you enter an alternate world. Being inside another reality has inspired films from the 80s classic Tron.
Taken prisoner and held captive within the digital world of the computer itself.
To the 2011 film Source Code.
You are inside the Source Code.
What is the Source Code?
It's a computer program, Captain.
But attempts to create a virtual reality device that people can use in their homes has never really hit it big. Now, some tech companies think they've cracked the code. The company Oculus just announced that in March, it'll release its long-awaited head-mounted display. Enthusiasts hope this will be the beginning of consumer-level virtual reality entering homes across the country. Assuming virtual reality does catch on, what would a future look like where it's as commonplace as a smartphone? KALW's Jeremy Dalmas ventured inside the digital world to find an answer.
Dude, I feel like I'm living inside of a novel, like that is the story of humanity for the 21st century. I think VR is going to be huge. It's going to define life as we know it.
Chris Miranda is a believer. He believes in the promise of virtual reality. After decades of hype, 2016 is the year that it will break into homes around the country. And Miranda is testing the edge of what these new devices are capable of. I was itching to know what a future might look like where humans were fully immersed inside of computer worlds. And I knew that Stanford University would have answers. Right now, I'm on campus in what looks like the quintessentially boring room. Carpeted gray floors, gray walls, and low ceilings.
So welcome to the Virtual Human Interaction Lab.
Shani Bauman manages the lab. Researchers here have been testing how people respond to VR since 2003. And today, I'm the guinea pig. First, she Velcros sensors to my ankles. They'll track me as I walk. For stereo sound, there are 24 speakers in the room. Bauman straps a small view screen onto my head. This is the main thing that will immerse me in virtual reality. I can't see anything except what's on the 3D screen. She tells me when I move my head, it will change the view of the virtual world to match.
Keep your head pointed forward for a moment.
So right now I just see gray.
Right there.
She boots up the program.
Oh, and I'm still in the room.
And suddenly, I'm transported. Except it's a digital copy of the room. It's weird. I feel like I'm still in the room, and I am still in the room, but I also know pretty much anything can happen now. And it does. Soon, the floor drops out. And I'm flying through outer space. There are giant colorful balls all around me.
Am I in like the Sweet Tart universe? Oh, and there's a little spaceship traveling.
Just for a moment. Now if you look below you.
It's cute. And soon the room is shaking as I fly by the sun. Then I slam back to Earth. I take off the helmet and I'm back.
This is the weirdest part, to be back in the real world. My head hurts a little now. I'm not sure if it's because it was on too tight. Maybe it was because I'm just not used to virtual reality yet.
I did feel like I was in a different place. To be honest, though, it didn't seem that earth-shattering. But maybe that's the most remarkable thing about it, how naturally I slipped into the virtual world. I didn't second guess it. But I might have if I had come here a few years ago. This headset I just used is made by a company called Oculus.
The previous head-mounted display was very big. It weighed, you know, over 3 pounds, and it cost about $40,000. This machine here is in the hundreds of dollar range, and it's obviously much smaller. It's lighter. It's less than a pound.
VR is getting smaller, cheaper, better. And interest is exploding right now.
This is a spectacularly busy time. I've been studying virtual reality for 20 years now.
Jeremy Balinson founded this lab, and he's seen more change in the past 18 months than in the past 15 years combined. Oculus funded its first prototype on Kickstarter in late 2012. Then, when Facebook bought them in July 2014 for $2 billion, that was the tipping point.
Sony, Samsung, Google, Microsoft, and the hardware companies are all competing right now. There is this arms race to get virtual reality in your living room first.
But we've been here before.
Fly over Mars. Take a trek through a prehistoric jungle. Tour a house that has not yet been built. It's called virtual reality.
That news clip could have been the intro to this story, but it was actually from ABC's show Primetime in 1991. In the 90s, VR was in the news, on magazine covers, and there were countless films about it. From Strange Days...
Have you ever jacked in? Have you ever wire-tripped?
...to the 13th floor.
A tower. A team of scientists have created a portal to a simulated universe.
Nintendo even made a game system called Virtual Boy in 1995.
The first three-dimensional stereo immersive 32-bit video game system ever.
That flopped and was forgotten. The technology wasn't there yet. But now, virtual reality enthusiasts are hoping for a near future where it's part of everyday life.
I do think it's going to have a major impact on the human condition in a way that, say, the printing press did have.
For Jeremy Balinson, VR is a fundamental shift.
Psychologically, being perceptually immersed inside of a scene is very different from reading it or watching it on TV.
And he has dozens of published papers that show how effective it can be. In one experiment, they had people cut down a tree to see if that would impact their paper use. It did.
And they had to cut down this tree. When the tree fell, the tree crashed the floor and it bounced their legs. Really powerful experience. People that do this study, they call me months later and they say, Jeremy, every time I walk down this toilet paper aisle, I think about your experiment.
Experiments like that show how a virtual experience can influence behavior in the non-computer world. In another experiment, they brought in second graders, had them go to a virtual SeaWorld, and a week later,
50% of them had formed false memories, meaning they believed that they'd actually gone to SeaWorld and swam with whales. So for kids now, the technology is good enough to blur that distinction. You know, we like to say the brain has not yet evolved to differentiate a compelling perceptual virtual experience from an actual one.
How long will it be before the technology advances enough that adults can't remember whether an experience was in the virtual or non-virtual world? It's thrilling, but scary. Think of the plot of The Matrix. Humanity enslaved in a virtual world without knowing it.
The Matrix is a computer-generated dream world, built to keep us under control.
But Balinson has more down-to-earth concerns.
What if online gambling feels like you're in Las Vegas? And what if every video game that you're playing, if you're killing people and you're feeling blood splattering on you and you're walking among the bodies? And I don't see virtual reality as a 10-hour-a-day type technology. My job is to create content that can be used for social good.
So what is that social good? I'm in a former movie theater in the middle of San Francisco's Mission District. The space is filled with virtual reality enthusiasts. 24 teams have 36 hours to cobble together programs that test the waters of what consumer-level VR can do. The obvious first thing is video games, but the most interesting possibilities are the everyday applications. Nancy Hall is one of the judges.
So what we want to see is we want to see healthcare applications.
So one group here is developing a training program for how to put on protective clothing for healthcare workers fighting Ebola. Another group is making a game that helps patients with physical therapy. The Army, as a matter of fact, is already using VR to help soldiers with PTSD.
They're actually taking the soldiers virtually back into a war zone and then teaching them how to deal with that stress.
There are people here working on programs to do product design within VR, browse the web in VR. There is even a software engineer from the Monterey Bay Aquarium who is working on making a 3D version of the Monterey Bay for teaching and research.
We're going to keep building on it, and eventually we're going to get speed motion integration.
The most vocal VR evangelist here is Chris Miranda. He hosts a podcast called Enter VR.
Every single facet of human life that we know right now can be touched by VR, can be converged through VR. We talk about medicine, we talk about architecture, we're talking about education, tourism, sex, gaming, entertainment. I mean, every aspect of reality can be transported to virtual reality. And that, in that sense, yes, VR can make reality even better.
Miranda calls virtual reality the final platform.
It will change what it means to be a human, because eventually VR will live inside our brains and we will all transcend through this metaverse, this layer of information on top of what we already see.
Wow, yeah. That sounds like so different than right now.
Welcome to the future, sir.
Portable communicators were around in science fiction for decades before cell phones became commonplace. But so were flying cars, and I'm still hanging around BART stations. Right now, VR is all promise. The most common issue that people I talk to seem to have with it is that they want to spend more time away from video screens and computers, not go inside of them. But there's a certain itch about it that doesn't seem like it's going away. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Dalmas.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Musician Mads Tolling lives in Albany, but he's played all over the world. He's a classically trained violinist and composer who loves jazz. His goal is to remind audiences that the violin is capable of playing all kinds of music. KALW's Jen Cheehan spoke with Tolling about using the basics as a point of departure.
How long have you been playing the violin? When did you start?
I started playing the violin when I was 6 years old. Initially, I was going by the Suzuki method. So I was kind of learning a lot by playing from ear with that method for about 5 years. And then after that, I kind of got into more conventional classical music. I was playing, you know, Mendelssohn violin concerto and Mozart violin concerto and Bach. And I guess at one point, I just had a desire to do something a little different. I mean, I love the classical music. But I had this urge to tap my feet when I played. You know, I couldn't help it when I was playing like Vivaldi's Four Seasons. I remember at the competition, like I wanted to tap my feet, so I was kind of hiding it by tapping my feet just with my toe.
Yeah, what did your teachers think of that?
You know, they said you're not supposed to do that. And that makes sense in classical music. But actually, when you start playing jazz, which I eventually got into, that you're supposed to tap your feet because you're keeping time. It's all based on the groove that you're playing within. It's a big part of that. And so, yeah, when I was about 14 years old, that's when I heard the music of Miles Davis. and I was out in the Far East Asia, and my dad gave me a cassette tape of Miles Davis playing Autumn Leaves, and that kind of changed my life, really. I mean, I keep telling this story, but it's really an important moment for me because I realized that this was the type of music, something just resonated within me. But of course...
Had you heard jazz before that?
I might have heard it, but it didn't.
It didn't touch you like that. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I didn't. Probably, I just didn't really notice it, or I wasn't really aware of the powerful expression it could have. You know, and I think still to this day, Miles was one of the greatest. You know, jazz artists, and had an expression that was just nobody else had that. You know, on that level. And so, yeah, it just drew me in, and I had to figure out how am I supposed to do this on a violin, because it's not a trumpet. A violin is not considered a jazz instrument.
Even though violinists have been playing jazz or have been part of jazz for a long time.
For a long time,
people
yeah.
don't necessarily think of that first.
No, I mean, if you look at the old Ken Burns videos about, you know, the history of jazz, you see back in the 20s and... you see a lot of jazz violinists playing jazz. There was a lot of that because, you know, that was before the saxophone, and so the violin could compete. But once you got the saxophone in the mix, it was just way louder, and it kind of took the violin out of the mix a little bit when that came around, and people started feeling the violin is kind of thin sounding. You know, doesn't have the sort of the low register of a nice smooth tenor sound, but it has something else to offer.
You were saying you had to figure out how to get to the sound that you loved through the violin.
Right. Yeah, it's the case with instruments where you're using them in a style that's not usually seen with the instrument. You don't have as many role models as, say, a saxophone, you know, Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, household names like that. With violin, it's a lot fewer all of a sudden.
I'm speaking with violinist and composer Mads Tolling. So you play jazz now, and you started as a classical musician. What are some of the differences in how you actually use your instrument?
So if I'm going to think about playing jazz and playing within rhythm, I have a lot of different ways I can do that. You know, in fiddle music, which is very famous, you have something called the shuffle bow. It goes like this. I'm basically, instead of playing all the notes, you know, I'm basically constantly moving the bow back and forth, creating kind of what's called a shuffle bow. So demonstrate this simply using one note. So I'm playing all the notes. So basically, I have a grid of eighth notes, right? And by accenting certain, some of those eighth notes, not equally, then you feel this groove, mm-hmm. and you feel like you want to dance. You want to move your, you know, your body to the music.
Is it analogous to how someone strums a guitar?
That's exactly right.
And you accent the certain.
See, if I didn't do that. Or if I just did the shuffle bow. Right. Then you start not having a groove like in Vivaldi, right? You know, those kind of things where you're playing all the notes.
So it doesn't swing. Like, yeah, it doesn't make you want to dance
the same
way. It
doesn't make you want to dance the same way. It makes you want to dance, but it's...
In more of a square minuet type
of way. Right, it's more kind of like 18th century, right? The other thing that I like to do is something called a chop, which is actually done at the frog of the bow. The shuffle bow is done for those violin experts, are done at the tip of the bow. So the chop is done at the frog, and it's a percussive sound that is very short. And chopping nature. See, by itself, it doesn't sound like much, but once you start adding integrating the, this is a down chop, and now the up. You, again, you start creating that groove, and then you add notes to it. It can sound something like this.
You've been working on this new project you're calling Mads Tolling and the Mads Men, where you play music of the Mad Men era from the 50s and 60s. Tell me more about that. What is it and where did the idea come from?
I love the period of the 60s, this golden age that you hear about. I think nowadays you listen to, you know, some movie music or some TV show music, maybe not as memorable as say, the Pink Panther, Mission Impossible, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. But not only film music or TV, we also do, you know, some of the hits from the 60s.
I saw a clip online of you playing the Beatles' Blackbird. Is
right.
that something that's in the show also?
That's right. Yeah, I have a solo version of that. And I was just thinking about that. That, you know, ties a little bit in what we're talking about with classical music and using techniques from that, because I do use sort of an arpeggio technique in playing that particular arrangement. I could play it a little bit.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Mads and the Mads Men will be playing with special guest Kenny Washington on Sunday at Yoshi's in Oakland and Thursday at Kumba in Santa Cruz. All the details are at kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
This week, we've been playing you a sound that we've played you before, back when we first launched Audiograph in 2013. Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? We sent KALW's Seth Samuel to the annual Golden Gate Kennel Club dog show to bring us the answer.
My name is Dana Bonetti.
My name is Shannon Lockwood.
So we're here at the Cow Palace today showing. There's a two-day show.
Can you tell me about your dogs you have? There's three big dogs here.
Yes, we have Bull Mastiffs, which are from England originally. These two are sisters. We have Gertie and Summer, and then we have a half-sister, Tila.
Summer actually yesterday took Winners, and today Gertrude took Winners.
My name is Mark Johnston. I have our two little dapples. One is Sarah and one is Patch. Miniature long-haired dachshunds. They're 9 months old.
I really love dachshunds because I have a dachshund at home in Atlanta.
You only have one?
Only one.
You can't just have one. They're like potato chips. You need more than that.
This year's Golden Gate Kennel Club Dog Show happens January 30th and 31st. Now, a lot of you knew where we recorded this week's sound. Our winner is Robert Edwards. Congratulations, Robert. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, it's our third birthday, so we have something special for you. Next week, we're going to play you a montage of Audiograph sounds. Ready for your sneak listen? Here we go.
This time it's love. My foolish.
you know what those were and where we recorded them? Give us a call and tell us. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106.
Thanks, Julie. If you've got ideas for where we should record next, tell us about them. Email us at news@kalw.org. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Shireen Adil, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.